Coming to you live from New York City, it's Insight on PRN, Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks for joining me this Thursday. Love to hear your comments today. Hope you have that number always saved in your phone or nearby, handy, 888-874-4888. We're going to be talking about Robin Williams, who, of course, is still on the top of the minds of many people. The dialogue of mental illness is out there, the conversation, which I think is the best thing, the only good thing that can come out of this, is being talked about. And then the show, basically, we're going to focus on a lot of mental health aspects, all the more of the positive ones. We're not going to rehash what all the other media outlets are doing, how he did it, why he did it, etc. I'm sure it's all speculation, number one. Except for the how. And that's not really important. What's important is, what do we take from this? And how do we apply this in our own lives? People we love. Chances are, during the course of this 1 hour broadcast, four people will take their lives. Every 14 minutes in America, someone dies by suicide. That's reported by the CDC. Through the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. I'm also going to be giving out some important numbers throughout the broadcast. So if you have a pen and you're not going to be able to listen throughout the entire broadcast, I'd like to give you one right now. A website, of course, afsp.org, afsp.org. It's a great website for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. They do tremendous work. They're probably the biggest organization in the United States for preventing suicide. And anyone ever at risk can call. Of course, they should call 911. But if they are at risk but not imminently, 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-TALK. So we're going to have a lot of informative information and a doctor, New York City psychologist on the show joining us momentarily to talk about mental health, depression, and other forms of mental health illness. But what bothered me throughout the last couple of days, since Monday, 4 days ago, is how the media has been reporting this. And I'm not going to belabor the point here because you know a lot of what's taking place. Very, very unnecessary and insensitive media coverage about facts, maybe not facts, speculation about what took place. And what I'm reading online, the unthinkable and very distasteful posts people are making, you know, I understand. Hey, listen, I'm all about having a good time, man. And levity is like, you know, an outlet in life. But, you know, there's a time and place for everything. But sometimes the extreme has been tested. People are photoshopping things that are just really grotesque. And I just don't understand. I guess it's the power of anonymity. Maybe if we weren't so anonymous, they wouldn't act like such a-holes and be so callous about how they're acting and what they're putting out in the world for everyone else to see. It's really sort of heinous. But, you know, on the upside, I saw a great post from James Taylor on his Facebook page. And James Taylor has, from what I understand, for the majority of his adult life, battled depression. As a matter of fact, one of his songs, is it Fire and Rain? I think so. Is about him being in an institution, a facility, years and years ago. And one of his lines say something like, I woke up this morning and I heard the news. Basically, one of the residents that he befriended when he was in a hospital took her life that morning. And we've heard this before that, you know, the reality is if somebody wants to take their life, they're going to take their life, whether in a facility, whether they're in a house with loved ones. Where there is a will, unfortunately, there is a way. But James Taylor had a really nice post. So if you get a chance, go onto Facebook. It's a public page. And read his comments. And there's some really, really some heartfelt comments from people that really kind of resonate Robin's message. You know, the guy was boundless energy, full of life and zeal. And a lot of people reported what they have experienced personally. And I have two comments on that. Number one, I'm happy to see in a non-anonymous way that people are able and willing to put their own personal experience out there. And not all of it applies or is totally relatable, but it can fall under the confines under the mental health umbrella, which is good because it took me a long time, outside my immediate family and even sometimes a good friend to really feel comfortable and say, hey, listen, man, this is what I'm going through. I'm having extreme panic attacks. I have a boatload of anxiety and I have a bout of depression that I'm experiencing. So wherever people are at in their mental health experience, that depends on them. It's a very personal feeling and standpoint, and you can't force somebody. It's their privacy at stake. So the other aspect is that, you know, some people write in and just again to make the point that it's very insensitive what they write. And, you know, people write about everything insensitively because they just try to start a firestorm. And that's why one of the reasons why, you know, Facebook and Twitter, those accounts, social media sites, you know, really just flourish because, you know, there's not a shortage of people who could give a crap what people think or how they hurt people's feelings. It's nice to know that Twitter is actually squeezing a lot of the accounts from people who are posting very rude and horrific things online, that they're stopping them from going up, or if they do go up, they're pulling them immediately. When I'm talking about the actual case of Robin Williams. And we'll share a story with you later in the show. I had a great, fantastic, and most memorable experience of meeting Robin Williams and spending about half an hour's time with him at a triathlon in La Jolla, California for the Challenge Athletes Foundation. I was working in radio and additionally working for a dot-com startup company for people with disabilities. And he really supported persons with disabilities, and he took part in this half Ironman triathlon. And I'll tell you a great story later on in the show, but basically there's two sides of Robin Williams I saw that day. Both of them were extremely well-received on my part. An affable guy beyond belief, and just a normal guy as well. And of course, you know, his insane energy. But in short, I had two conversations with him. One was just between myself and his handler and a world-class triathlete. And it was just, you know, four guys shooting the breeze. And then the other side I saw of him when I was interviewing him after the race about people with disabilities, his perspective, why he takes part in such great opportunities to raise the awareness and funds for this community of people who needed so. And so he actually just took the microphone away from me and we just had a blast. And so, you know, that's always been an indelible memory I have of Robin Williams. And, you know, as many people, as you've heard and read throughout the last 4 days, and I'm sure for the months and years to come, that he was just like that. What you saw is what you get. You know, someone who has a mental health disease such as depression does not make them a bad person, by all means, by any stretch of the imagination. Most people who suffer mental health illness are very, very bright people, very sensitive people, extremely sensitive, and sometimes can be quiet. I myself am an extrovert. I'm not a quiet person. Sometimes in between recordings, I can be a little quiet, but otherwise, I always have a fair amount to say. Just ask my wife, who said, you know what, I knew what I was in for when I met you, and be careful what you wish for, I say to her. So I'd like to welcome to the show a New York City psychologist, Dr. Jen Hartstein, who is going to give some insight on what happened and sort of the landscape of mental health as we know it today. Dr. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. How are you this morning?
Oh, pretty good. Beautiful day in New York City, right?
Yes, absolutely. Although a little crisp. It's still August.
Hey, we'll take it instead of the 90-degree and endless crazy humidity.
Yes.
So I imagine yourself, like myself, that when you hear of such a terrible thing, an act, losing such a major personality, an icon on many levels, the first thing, obviously, is complete sadness. The second thing is, after a proper amount of time, that you feel like, well, if there is an upside, and I'm a true realist and optimist, and if there's a silver lining here, is that maybe conversation and dialogue will help, you know, change the way the perception and stigmas that exist currently with mental health.
Absolutely. I think, if anything, it has brought all of us into a conversation. We talk a lot about other illnesses that are, you know, quote unquote, more acceptable. We talk about cancer, we talk about heart disease, we talk about breast cancer, all of those things. But mental illness of any kind is something that we really have a hard time having open dialogue about. And as, you know, because it's Robin Williams and it's someone we all know and it seems so shocking, I think it is allowing for all of us to have some conversation, for people to feel more accepted in that conversation. I think that's, you know, the silver lining in all of this.
And when you think about, you know, a lot of people we're going to be addressing today, obviously, probably may not know a lot about mental health. And so we're going to take that foothold. There's two major components to it, the physical and biological. Mm-hmm. If you want to give a quick overview of both, that'd be great.
Sure. So there's actually even, you know, there's a combination of things. So we have the physical part of it, where there is really a brain chemistry component, where our bodies just our brains aren't working the same as everybody else's. We know that that's true generally, but then there is a real breakdown in how our neurotransmitters, which is what kind of fuels our emotions and fuels all the information. It's like our brains are an electrical panel, and the neurotransmitters are the circuit and the current that bring the information through.
Great analogy.
So if we, it's the easiest way to think about it.
Sure.
If there is a short in the circuitry, something isn't going to work mm-hmm. right. So for people who suffer from depression, they tend to have less of a neurotransmitter called serotonin and sometimes dopamine, and those things just aren't as present as they are in people who have a more stable mood. So some of it's really out of their control. It's not like they are choosing to be depressed, although people oftentimes get in that habit of saying, just snap out of it. Well, you know, if it were that easy, then they would do that, because it's not really fun to feel miserable all the time. So there is the biological kind of physical part in our bodies that kind of cause the depression to happen, and some people are really born with that way. Trauma can trigger that. So that brings in some of the environmental components that also add to people's depression. You can have lots of bad things happen to you that is going to change how you view the world. So if you've had a trauma of significance happen to you, or if you've just had lots of loss in your life, it will impact your mood state in a long-term kind of a way. So the environment and the kind of biology mixing together creates mental illness of all different kinds, anxiety, depression, mm-hmm. you know, different kinds of things. So we have to really, post-traumatic stress disorder, so we have to think about what their interaction is of those things. But it doesn't exist one or the other. It's really an ongoing transaction between them both.
Going back to the brain chemistry, so mm-hmm. you talked about serotonin and dopamine, which a lot of people know, and that's why a lot of people are into physical exercise, because sometimes, you know, runner's high, that's how mm-hmm. the whole term comes from. That's what it is. You're releasing dopamine.
Yep.
But in terms of medication, I think it's obviously a misconception that, you know, if you take medication, it's going to make you someone else. But essentially, you're replacing that missing serotonin with, I believe most of the medications fall underneath the umbrella of SSRI, serotonin
right.
something reuptake inhibitors.
Right. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Like how I glossed over that?
It is a mouthful. So, since we need this extra circuitry, what they really do is they allow kind of, instead of the current kind of being sucked up by the next circuit, it allows more of it to kind of build so that there's more to choose from, so to speak. So it allows there to kind of be more serotonin to then grab onto, whereas if someone just has too little of it, there isn't enough mm-hmm. to make what you need. So most of the medications that are on the market now, the kind of current brand is what's called an SSRI. And what they do is really, they don't change your personality, but they do lift the cloud.
The fog, sure.
So that you can actually figure out what skills you need to use to live life, or how to change your thinking, or how to embrace the positives instead of only focusing on the negatives, how to do all that stuff. But when you're in that fog, you can't get out of that. And I think that's a myth, you know, it really mm-hmm. is a myth that medications are going to change who you are. Advil doesn't change you when you take it for your headache. You know,
you've never seen me on Advil.
Oh, well, I better watch out for that. But most of us, right, not going to change us significantly. I mean, people drink coffee every day.
Sure.
coffee is technically a stimulant, like nicotine, like what we give people for ADD. So does it change you that much? Not necessarily.
And
so
sometimes when you stop drinking it, the withdrawals, it can be very painful, sure.
I stopped drinking caffeine 2.5 years ago. It was a bad week.
And you're still shaking.
Yeah, it was awful. That headache is awful.
It's brutal.
But, you know, you kind of get through it. And so you have to remember that it could actually improve your life. And instead of being like, well, it's going to change who I am as a person, we want to think about, could that be for the better? It doesn't necessarily always have to be for the worse.
And it's great that you made the point where it makes you, where actually the real work can begin. Because for myself, it kind of came out of the blue after, I'm going to tell the story in a little bit on the show, about after losing my brother a few years after he died, I started experiencing extreme panic attacks. And I was like, what in the world? I thought I was losing my mind. Mm-hmm. And anxiety came on. And then, of course, we can talk about this in a few minutes. Usually coupled with that, and I don't think they understand truly why, and you can possibly shed some light on that, is depression, because they kind of come in hand. So, you know, you don't have that much control over it, but in the beginning, you're like, you know, you're overwhelmed. And
right.
Once that, maybe why is this happening to me? Can I get through it? And then if you choose to go the medication route, which I recommend for certain people, and that's a very personal position and stance to take, that it allows you just to be you, to say, okay, wow, got through that. Now I need to realize what went wrong and how I can change my life and moving forward.
Right. And I think that you bring up something really important too, Mark, which is that anxiety and depression are very often two sides of the same coin. And so it's very often they come together. And the anxiety kind of breeds this, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to live my life, and this very hopeless, frustrated thinking. And then the depression kind of adds to the anxiety, which is like, oh my God, I'm never going to get out of this hole. So we get into this very bad spiral.
Very cyclical, yep.
And one feeds the other. So it's not uncommon for them to kind of walk hand in hand down the street. And it's important when that fog lifts to really find a place. And therapy doesn't work for everybody. So it could be a close friend that's willing to sit and talk with you. It could be clergy. It could be, you know, a great trainer that talks with you. As long as it's in a healthy choice. You know, very often that is in a therapeutic environment where you can learn how to live life on life's terms, because that's how it is. And that's what life is. You know, you have to show up and you have to be in it. And that's not easy for everybody, and everybody chooses a different way of doing that.
Now, what's your philosophy? I believe that people are wired a certain way. And I'm not going to use Robin Williams as an example. I'll use myself as an example.
Mm-hmm.
As when I... you know, I don't know. It's a very subjective situation when you live through it. But my panic attacks were definitely extreme from what I learned from talking to. I mean, I was changing my sheets sometimes twice a night because I was sweating so much. I lost just tons of weight. I mean, I was just a hot mess, man.
Right.
So it was pretty high on the Richter scale of, you know, panic attacks. And so, but then came intrusive thoughts. And for people who don't know what intrusive thoughts are, maybe to put it in perspective of, maybe if you're a parent, you think about maybe the loss of a child. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now take it to the point where if you suffer from anxiety, you think you have self-harm thoughts. Or if you're depressed, you have thoughts of self-harm. I used to stand on the subway platform and a train would be coming toward me going to work. And I'd be like, wow, I should jump in front of it. And
mm-hmm.
it was totally putting me in a mode of panic. But in the back of my mind, I knew I would never do it. I was never capable of doing such something. So it never
right.
even kept me, disturbed me that much. The thought disturbed me, the actual thought, but not the actual act. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think there is kind of a continuum of things we want to think about. So you mentioned the idea of self-harm. So that's a whole nother topic that could fill up a whole lot of time. But just to touch on that quickly, because just to bring it back to Robin Williams for a second, we know that there was a pocket knife there, and we know that there were some cuts on his wrists, and we don't know what that actually was, right? But there are a lot of people who self-harm, and there is an immediate belief that if you're self-harming, you're automatically suicidal, and that's not actually true. So self-harm becomes a way to regulate emotion. So the way you're talking about it is, God, I'm feeling so panicked. If I do some sort of self-harming behavior, which could be a lot of different things,
mm-hmm.
I will feel better. And that is a way to regulate depression, anxiety, mania for some people, that feeling of absolutely being devoid of emotion, right? Kind of having nothing. It makes you feel alive. So people use self-harming in that way, as a regulatory thing, like someone would use a run outside, they might self-harm. It's maladaptive because you can't do it forever, and you could accidentally really hurt yourself or kill yourself or, you know, cut a ligament, any of those things. So it's something we don't want anybody to be doing. But that's one end of this continuum. But it doesn't mean that you're actually suicidal. You can, but what you're, the thoughts you're talking about is kind of what we call passive suicidal ideation. So you have thoughts of wanting to die, not wanting to be here, wishing life would be over or that you could be someplace else, but no intent to act on those thoughts. There are a lot of people who live with that kind of thinking, and they never will act on it, but they think about it a lot.
Also because I believe you can actually wear out the thought process and your body reacts less to that intrusive mm-hmm. thought. So it's almost like when you see an annoying person every day, maybe the first 20 times it really got you aggravated, and after a while it's just, oh, there's that jackass.
Right, right, exactly. And there's
exposure.
There is some, right. There's some element to, like, it becomes less, you know, and there is some interesting kind of research out there these days that talks about if you're feeling an emotion and you just say it out loud, God, I'm so anxious today, just putting it out there brings that level of intensity of emotion down, because when we keep it in our head, we do ruminate, we do focus on it, we do only think about all the negatives, we don't stop and think about, well, okay, so I'm anxious, what do I want to do about it? We just get stuck on the gerbil wheel of it. So I think that's really important, but many people have these kind of passive suicidal thoughts during the day where there is no intention, but there is the thought, you know. So as a psychologist, I'm constantly assessing for, is there a plan, you know? So I might have the thought that I want to die, and I might think, oh, I'm going to jump in front of the train. And then my third thought might be, but I'm never going to do that. I have a family. I have a kid. I have, you know, I want to go to college, whatever. I have goals that I want to work for, so it's not going to be something I follow through on. And so the key kind of in this triad of, you know, kind of thought, intention, and plan is the intention. You know, if there's a plan, I'm really worried. But if there's any intention, you know, that's when all bets are off and we have to really figure out how to keep that person safe, because the thoughts don't necessarily mean action.
Sure. So as a physician, you're sitting there assessing that and you're waiting for the follow-up comments and you're hoping to hear, but I want to go to college or support my kids, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know,
is there a future goal?
Yes.
And if there's a future goal, then I'm going to be, I feel, now I may still, that's not to say mm-hmm. that I'm not still going to be very on alert and
sure.
concerned if I'm hearing suicidal speaking in my office, but I'm definitely a little less concerned if there's no intent, but I would never do it. There's no way. Yeah, here's what I would do, but not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's lots of that happens, and I think we have to just be able to differentiate between overreacting and underreacting, and I think that's the very, very, very fine line in all of this.
My guest is Dr. Jen Hartstein. She's a New York City psychologist. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. We're talking about mental health. I'd love to hear your comments. If you have a question for myself or Dr. Jen, who I'm coining you as right now, give us a call at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. 4888. A moment ago, we talked about being wired or have a propensity for something. Do you believe that, you know, people, for example, are able to maybe see the forest through the woods easier than others?
Yeah, I mean, we are. We are born, you know, there are people who are born with a more optimistic tendency and people who are born with a less optimistic tendency. I mean, there is some of that wiring. And then that is advanced by the environments in which we're born. So,
true.
It's a combination of all of that. And I do, you know, even in the same family, it can be very different because we aren't, unless you're, you know, an identical twin where your genetics is much more in line, we are all very different. So, and how our parents react to us are very different. You know, I have an older brother, how my parents dealt with him and how my parents dealt with me, very different because of our personalities.
That's enough to put you on a therapist's couch.
Well, exactly. Sometimes that is a true thing. Or in the therapist's chair, either way, you know. So I think it's a tough, we have to keep in mind that there's so many factors and we are not ever walking in someone else's shoes to really know what that person's dealing with.
And chances are in your lifetime, you're going to experience a bout of depression nowadays, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, 1 in 10, you know, the current statistics are pretty disturbing. 1 in 10 people will be diagnosed with depression in the United States over the course of their lifetime. I mean, and that's, and in some states it's more than in other states, but the fact is that 10% of Americans are struggling with this.
Wow. And that's the reported numbers.
That's the reported number. And then in doing some research before we were going to talk, what they were also saying is that depression is being diagnosed more and more every year, up to 20%. It goes up to 20% more every year. Now, is that because the population also is growing every year, or because
demands,
more people are reporting
sure.
it, demand for services increases, who knows? But those numbers are staggering
yeah.
when we stop and think about how many Americans that mean suffer from depression every day.
It's gargantuan. At the head of the show, I'm not sure if you were listening, but during the course of this hour, which is really staggering, fact that, you know, four people could die by suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Every 13 minutes, someone takes
yep.
their life.
And in that, they leave six survivors. So you know, the circle, and then we really have to worry in that kind of numbering what the contagion effect is, especially for young, you know, for teenagers and young adults, is they are hearing all about it, and then what's the likelihood that they may actually act on it, because maybe the thought wasn't in their head, and now they see, you know, kind of ease and peace, and there is a for sure documented contagion effect to the media coverage and the discussions about suicide. So it's really a very sticky, important subject to really talk about, and really sticky to talk about, because we want to make sure people don't kind of think that that's the only answer.
Dr. Jen, what is the ratio and or percentage of an onset of depression reoccurring if it does happen to someone in their lifetime?
You know, it's a pretty high reoccurrence rate. It's hard to say because I think it's really underreported, and I think sometimes people are walking around feeling depressed, but think that that's just their baseline. They just think that's their normal. So when they really finally seek treatment, it's harder for them to determine what that is. We do know that people who have suicide attempts are three times more likely to reattempt. So getting them into treatment after a suicide attempt is really important, because so often those first 3 months after an attempt are like the most critical. And so we know that we have to really be aware of kind of how much treatment people are getting, when they're getting into treatment. We know that women are diagnosed with depression more than men, you know, almost twice as likely to be diagnosed with depression over men. Again,
but men are more likely to take their lives, correct?
Men are more likely to succeed in taking their lives, and a lot of that is because of choice of means.
True.
They tend to choose more violent methods. Mm-hmm. Historically, the two ages where suicide was most high was in teenagers, where it's the third leading cause of death from 10 to 24-year-olds, and in the elderly. But over the past 5 to 10 years, the largest growing number of suicides is occurring in the 45 to 64-year-old age range in which Robin Williams fell. A lot of that is question, you know, there's a lot of question about, is that because of heading for retirement, you know, financial state of the United States, not finding meaning in your life in that period of time, kind of that midlife crisis.
Sure.
Lots of hypotheses as to why, but it does seem to be that depression is kind of rearing its ugly head the most during that time period, and then suicides have increased incrementally in that age range.
Now, touching on the Robin Williams scenario, I would imagine, certainly as a physician, when you hear the fact that someone was diagnosed with clinical depression and have a history with substance abuse, I mean, that's a wrong
yeah.
combination.
Yeah, and we do know that with that comorbidity of meaning having substance abuse issues and a diagnosed mental illness, they often go together, because so much of the substance use can be self-medication.
Absolutely,
you know, they're not,
sure.
And so we know for a long time, you know, who knows for how long that's what he was doing. So it's a bad combination altogether, because your cognition, you know, your thinking is already a little skewed when you're depressed. Now add substance abuse in there and it's going to be skewed even more. And you're likely to be more impulsive. You're likely to be more, you know, engaging in riskier behaviors, or just at greater risk, because the hopelessness increases. So it's a really tough combo of things.
And it makes it harder to, you know, if he was in therapy right now, or if someone is in therapy right now, and they have obviously a diagnosis, and with different, you know, alcohol and different substance abuses, heroin,
yep.
et cetera, makes it hard to obviously diagnose and to weed through to the actual problem. Obviously, self-medication comes up as the top number one reason why they're doing such a thing.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, and add to the fact that alcohol is in itself a depressant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's not exactly using drugs that are going to improve his mood. I mean, we all think alcohol is not a depressant, but ultimately it is. The crash after the alcohol is really not so great. So it's, you know, there's all this masking. And then just for Robin Williams in particular, his personality, you know, where was he at his genuine self? I don't know that we, you know, as warm and as kind and as fabulous as we have seen him to be and as hysterically funny, is that his genuine self? Was his more genuine self the person who was in his house on Monday?
You know, balled up underneath the covers.
Exactly. And I don't know that that's something anybody will ever really know.
It's not really important. But the thing is, that's what I always thought. This guy must be, anyone who can act so frenetic has to be bipolar.
Right.
I mean, to be from one extreme to the next, it's just...
Right.
It's just exhausting even to watch somebody like that.
And I think that there is a lot of belief that he, that aside from the depression, that he actually was bipolar. And I think we don't know. You know, I don't treat him. His treating providers certainly aren't coming out. I know I read a really fabulous article with Carrie Fisher where she recounts a conversation. You know, she has bipolar, and she recounts a conversation with him where he's like, "But I'm not bipolar." You know, and I think that who knows if he turned on this light to cover up the depression, and he just learned so well how to act opposite to it that he could turn it on and be a bit larger than life, or if in fact he was bipolar and those ups and downs were really so dramatic and he just, you know, knew when he had to turn it on or turn it off. It's hard to say, but I think that, you know, one of bipolar's major components is a very deep and dark depression for a lot of people. And it's kind of classic incarnation, right? You have the manic highs and the very low lows. So, it's so hard to be able to really diagnose. I mean, I think everybody's kind of doing that kind of posthumously, you know, doing some psychological autopsies on what really was going on with him and how could it have been prevented or not. And all of that are questions we'll never really know.
Now, with my experience with panic, anxiety, and depression, and, of course, with my brother, I lost my brother 22 years ago to suicide, that with Robin Williams and other people who are in the public eye or not, and when I read about someone who's older and has struggled all their life, I almost understand, you know what, maybe they just gave up the fight because every day can be, there's a book about Alzheimer's, I think it's called the 36-hour day, something like that, 72-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like you can take that, you know, nomenclature and apply it because, I mean, the days can be so long and so dark and so dreadful. And you hear this all the time from patients and maybe some of our listeners are shaking their heads going, wow, yes, I totally understand that. Sleepless nights, you know, there's no separation of days. And maybe at 63 years of age, you know, he said to himself, and I'm not advocating this in any shape or form, but I'm just trying to wrap my mind around it, that he said, you know what, I just have no fight left.
Right. And it's, you know, entirely possible. I mean, I think that we all, you know, I want to give my clients as many skills and as much ability to live lives that they want to have, you know, because if they're, you know, this is a man who everyone is saying, you know, there's a lot of negativity around what happened too, of with all the money that he had and with all of the fame, like he couldn't buy the right treatment or he couldn't
nothing.
Buy happiness and you know, none of that matters. You can be poorer than poor and be the happiest human being ever, and you can own the world and be miserable and you know, money is not a factor in here, although people keep looking to that. And I think that there is a point at which, you know, people just say, this is not the life I want to have, and they can't, and they've tried everything and they can't figure out what to do next. And so they allow themselves the choice. And I think we accept it in other illnesses, you know, that if I am a person with a chronic illness and I've done all the treatment that I can and there's nothing left and I overdose, there is an acceptance of that. You know, if I have cancer, that's going to kill me anyway. Well, people die from depression the same way they die from cancer. And because people think it's a choice to have depression, it makes that argument much murkier and much harder for people to have openly.
Very valid point. And also people who are undergoing cancer treatment sometimes decide to stop getting treatment.
Yep.
And so are they a coward at that point?
Right. No. No.
They're in control of their own destiny.
We would never call them a coward, although we know that someone called Robin Williams' choice a cowardly. So this is where I think there is this, to go back to kind of where we started this conversation of a silver lining, is that maybe it will open people's eyes to the fact that mental illness is not something to hide behind, and that we don't have to put on the mask all the time, and we can just be who we are and be open about it. You know, and I think there are some barriers being broken down. You know, Brandon Marshall, who plays for the Chicago Bears, and is one of the top, you know, NFL players around came out with his struggles with mental illness with borderline personality disorder, and he's really working to bring awareness and knowledge about that. And that's a huge, you know, here is an African-American athlete who people, you know, who's male, and people are talking about mental illness with him. And so if we can start to have more of that, not out of tragedy, but kind of in a proactive way,
sure.
I think that that will also help this conversation to be more open and people to be more accepting.
Absolutely. Now, families, obviously, this is a people can be predisposed. I think I'm predisposed in my family. That's not something, you know, second, third generation from Ireland that people commonly talked about. You just went to the pub and, you know, bellied up to the oak and that was it. But knowing that if you do have a predisposition and you feel good, what should some of the warning signs, and obviously people shouldn't be hypersensitive like, oh my God, I feel bummed out today. I have depression, of course, but, and I'm oversimplifying this, but what are symptoms that are people should possibly recognize and or keep an eye at that are predisposed and not?
Sure. Well, okay, so we want to think about, you know, just notice in your family. Like, when you go to the doctor and they ask for family history, we tend to know if there's heart disease, if there's stroke, if there's any of that stuff. So I think start even in your family talking to people. What did you notice in your family? What did you, you know, how did you notice your parents acted? How did you notice your grandparents acted? Like, start some of those conversations too, I think, because you're not afraid to say, whoa, was there any heart disease in my family? But we are afraid to say, was there any depression or schizophrenia or manic depression, any of those things.
Yeah, why was Grandma Lily watering the flowers nude?
Right. We don't ask those questions. We just kind of, it just becomes family folklore.
Absolutely.
And we need to ask what that's all about. And then I think if you notice some behavior changes in yourself, one or two bad days happens, you know, Mercury's in retrograde and the weather's bad and it's cold and there's all sorts of reasons why people have bad days. But if those bad days kind of string together for a week or more, or you notice that you're losing a lot of interest in things you used to be interested in, or maybe you're not sleeping or you're wanting to sleep all day and be up all night, you know, significant behavioral changes, ask, you know, check in with somebody. Hey, you know, these are the things that are going on for me. And if you feel most comfortable going to your internist, then go to your internist first. But and say, maybe, you know, make sure that it's maybe not something physical, but then ask them, you know, these are still things that are going on for me. Should I go talk to someone? Sometimes the internist has the best referrals that you can have, and you often already have a relationship with that person.
Do you think it's common? Sorry to interrupt you, Dr. Jen.
Okay.
Do you think it's common for people not to notice the subtle changes over 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and next thing you know, they wake up and wham, it's upon them?
Yeah, I do think that we find explanations for things.
You're right.
Oh, well, you know, my job changed. Oh, well, you know, my husband and I have been fighting. Oh, I got divorced. You know, we look for the explanation rather than stopping and being like, I just don't feel right and I need to do something about it. And I think that's half the battle, is we're so busy and we're so distracted that we miss the signs that we might need to be paying attention to.
Now, you've been practicing for several years as a professional. Have you seen the landscape change in terms of, medically speaking, insurance companies being more acceptive of coverage? Because I would imagine if it would be great if obviously we had more policymakers, lawmakers, government, et cetera, and in conjunction, or if there was policy made that insurance companies had to maybe even do some, you know, we're always telling cigarette companies and alcohol companies what they can't do. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should start telling insurance companies what they should do and start telling them promote positive mental health. So
wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't that be nice?
So, you know, wishful thinking. If we put it out in the air, maybe it'll happen.
Yes.
But there have been some changes. So certain things have changed, such as... And I'm gonna forgive me for blanking on the name of the senator who created
it. You're forgiven, sure.
But there is now, I know, in New York, something called Timothy's Law.
Yes.
And Timothy's Law is for people who have chronic mental illnesses, who maybe have maxed out their benefits with insurance, but they qualify under Timothy's Law, which a mental health provider fills out some forms and some paperwork, and they get extended service because it's very clear that they need the ongoing support with therapy. And that was huge because the senator's son committed suicide, and so out of that grew legislation. Because, you know, unfortunately, we don't always push for change until the change affects us directly. So that was one thing that has changed. There has been more push to look at mental illness as a physical illness and to provide treatment services the same way that you would provide it for medical. You know, I know businesses are looking at it as, you know, they providing leave the same kind of a way that if someone needs to take a medical leave, that medical leave includes mental illness, not just physical illness.
Great.
You know, so there are some movements slowly in that direction. It's never going to be enough. And I think because there is so much subjectivity tied in with some of this, it's hard. You know, if I have to call in, I don't do this so much now, but historically I've had to call in to, you know, beg for days for people if I was working in the hospital setting or I was working in an outpatient partial hospitalization, which is like an everyday program for people. And I'd have to call up and fight with insurance companies about letting me have more days for the person. And I was the clinician sitting with the patient, but I had to talk to someone who's never seen the patient, is going by a checklist, maybe has no mental health training, and trying to convince them that they should give me access.
So bottom line. Yep.
One thing that we could see insurance companies do is, for those reviews, really have mental health people doing the reviews so they understand more about what's being asked of them. And certain companies are doing that, but it's hard because you're fighting, you know, oh, well, they don't meet the criteria exactly. We can't provide more service. And we know that that's a risk for increased depression is not having access to services. So it's a big challenge.
Absolutely. And I think some big ground has been made. Obviously, mm-hmm. you know, things of this caliber that we mentioned before, you know, can keep the dialogue going on. And lastly, if someone does have to, you know, voluntarily go away to a facility to mm-hmm. seek medical treatment, is this, and have you seen this historically, maybe with some of your patients and colleagues and maybe reports that you read, do most people typically tell their place of employment or they just take their vacation?
You know, I think it's a mixed bag. I think that because there's such stigma still,
exactly.
people are afraid to tell their employers. And I would like to hope that people can start to tell their employers because then they actually might be surprised at how their employers react. But it's so hard to know, and I think it's like a ping pong game.
And that's understandable because they don't want to be perceived as not even capable of doing their job when they return.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's Joe Blow is on medication now. He went to the loony farm for, you know,
right.
3 weeks, and he's a different person now. When,
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
He could be better than anybody there.
Well, and it's very interesting. You know, colleges don't call it the kids that leave college because they need support go on medical leave. They don't have to describe what the leave is,
fantastic.
And I don't think they have to describe it for medical parts either. They just have to say they're going on medical leave, and when they try to go back, they have to get the doctor treating them to describe why they're okay to come back. And then the schools will know a little more. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know that it's bad that the schools know because then they can increase supports also. So it's really where is there going to be the most support and how can we increase acceptance that this is just what's happening. And, you know, if 10%, you know, 10, if a company has 100 employees, 10 of them have depression.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, 10%. Yeah. You know, it's been a conversation that's been going on for, you know, years and years. And it's something that's been in existence for the dawn of time. And people will always take their lives
mm-hmm.
Because just people, it's human nature. I think that, you know, obviously you can bring a horse to water. You can't force
right.
them, you know, et cetera. But there is so much out there, so much education, so much preventative medicine out there. And we should also mention, especially from my experience, that, you know, a therapist is like a good mechanic. You know, sometimes you go to a mechanic, you're like, you know, I really don't like the way I'm being treated here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you go to a second mechanic and third or fourth. And that's so true with therapists, whether they're psychologists, whether they're a, what are some other degrees?
You can be a psychologist, a social worker.
Social worker,
a licensed
yes.
mental health counselor. Mm-hmm.
LCSW, something like that,
yeah,
social worker.
Yeah, an art therapist. But I agree with you. I tell people all the time that they shop around for a car. And,
yes.
and they make sure that they research the best refrigerator,
mm-hmm.
that they should interview more than one therapist. And especially, you know, I work with a lot of teenagers, and I have said to parents, your kid needs to be interviewing the therapist that you're choosing for them as much as you are, because they're the ones sitting in the room. And I've had kids that have been like, I want to come see you, and my parents want me to go see this other person, and we'll have a meeting about what's the best kind of choice. And be a therapeutic consumer. Find the person who's going to help you get what you need. And I think people go, oh, that's the person I was referred to. I'm just going to go.
Yes. And I think what they do is they chalk it up to every doctor, whoever classification they saw is going to be the same way. And then they just retreat and say, well, that's not going to work for me. And then it wallows and maybe builds and snowballs from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the additional part is that we get stuck in that belief that this is the only person.
Yes.
And I think that even if you've seen a therapist for 5 years, it might be time for a change.
Mm-hmm.
Because after a while, that you guys might have hit a peak and you might need a different perspective, and that's okay,
too. It's like any other relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always, when I was in therapy, often we always had, like, I would do, like, a three-month, four-month, like, readdressing, like, State of the Union, almost like the president. Like, where are we? Where have we been? Where are we going?
Sure.
Where do we stand? How does, is this working? Yes, exactly.
Totally have a check-in. Have a check-in on are you meeting your treatment goals? You know, I'm a big believer that I don't think people need to be in therapy forever. I think the door to therapy is revolving and it's always open, but, you know, come do what you need to do for yourself so you feel that you want to be in a place that you're in, and then go. And that may take some people a year, that may take people some 3 years, that may, you know, take someone 6 months. It's going to be different for everybody. And you know, and I think people then get afraid to say to the therapist, oh, I think I'm done. But, you know, take control of your own treatment. I think that's the other part that's so important.
Well said, well said. Dr. Jen Hartstein, thank you so much for your time and great insight. I mean, you had some really, really invaluable points to make. And, you know, it's unfortunate Robin Williams is no longer here. But all we can do is move forward and, you know, turn something positive from the negative. That's for sure.
Definitely, definitely.
Thanks so much. Be well.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Mark Frau. This has been PRN.FM. We're going to talk now, continue the conversation. We've got a few more minutes left in the show. I want to tell you about my meeting with Robin Williams. It was back in 1998 in La Jolla, California. I was doing a triathlon for an organization called Challenge Athletes Foundation. And it's a great foundation that gives people with disabilities the opportunity to partake in sports. And they give them the maybe a prosthetic leg that they need or a modified bicycle, whatever the case may be. So I was working for a radio station back then in New York City and also for startup.com. And one of my reasons, well, the main reason actually for me to go out there was not only to do the race, but was to interview Robin Williams. So I said, absolutely. What time is my flight? So I get there, and it's a beautiful day, and here I am. I'm standing a few feet away from Robin Williams. I'm like, wow, this is great. So I go over and introduce myself, I believe first to his handler, who I cannot remember his name. It was so nice, a big guy, and I was going to look for his information because I'm sure it's probably the same gentleman. He's been with him for Robin with for years, and the gentleman, unfortunately, who found Robin, just to send him a note of condolence. But we had a great conversation, and Robin couldn't have been a nicer guy. I introduced myself, told him who I was and what I was doing there, and I'd like to have a few words with him on tape after the ride, after the triathlon. We're actually just doing a leg of the triathlon. We were doing the cycling. And my teammate at the time was Michaela Jones. She was doing the swim. Michaela Jones back then, and still is, I think, one of the fastest women on the planet of Earth that can swim. She is incredibly fast and incredibly beautiful, easy on the eyes. So here is the setting. We're in a transition area where all the bicycles are and no one else is allowed in there. And I'm standing there with Robin Williams, his handler left, and walking by is Scott Tinley. Scott Tinley back then was one of the top triathlete guys in the world. He was probably the top, probably around 1990, 94, but still very well known. So the three of us are kind of talking it up, and the race started. So again, we're just doing the bike portion of the ride, which is 60 miles, an incredibly hilly course in San Diego and La Jolla. So we're just talking. Next thing you know, all I hear is, Mark, 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 this beautiful 6-foot-tall Australian woman's running towards me, and that's my partner, Michaela Jones. So I'm flustered. I'm not even ready. Here I am just hanging out with Scott Tinley and Robin Williams, you know, pinching myself. But this is actually true? Wow, this is incredible. Wow, this is a memorable moment I will never, ever forget for a lifetime, or 5 or 10. So next thing you know, I have to get on my bike, put my helmet on, and I didn't even know which way to head out of the transition zone to begin the bike portion of the race because I had never been first at the bike transition area. You know, how? What? No way. So all I hear in the background is Robin Williams going, go, boy, go, go, boy, go. How hysterical is that? Robin Williams is yelling at me, "Go, boy!" I'll never, ever forget those words and hear that voice in my head. So after a few hours of an arduous bike ride, get back to the transition area. And, you know, Robin and I reconvene at a good time. We both get some nourishment in us. We're hanging out. And I bring out my recorder and ask him some questions. And he looks at me and he goes, "You know, you really look like Rob Lowe," and starts going into this like whole Rob Lowe voice, and then asks me if he can take the microphone from me, takes my microphone away from me, and starts interviewing me. As you have seen and read, the guy is hysterical and the guy is very manic. I mean, his energy was so frenetic. He just made, you know, what was an exciting time, an over the moon dream of a conversation and interview. It was hysterical. It was more like a comedy routine. And I have a picture with it of the interaction of Robin and I, which I will post up on PRN.FM. It'll be on the Insight page. The show name, Insight, PRN.FM. Give us a couple hours to get that up. But I couldn't say enough about the guy. He couldn't have been more hospitable and more true to helping people in need. And this is just a very small snapshot of a man that I have experienced. And what I've read is that, you know, he was a generous soul, a most generous soul. And a lot of people who suffer from depression are very, very sensitive people. Sometimes that to a fault. Overly sensitive. And, you know, most of us can be overly sensitive and it doesn't have any ramifications in terms of being depressed by all means. But I mean, research has shown that that can be the case. But I wanted to share that story with you because it's just something that's indelible in my mind, forever etched, and really just kind of showed me the real person that he was. And of course, I brought the footage back to the magazine. They ran with it. It was a great interview. And the dialogue back then aired on my radio show. And I will. I was remiss in bringing it today because it's on a DAT tape, a digital audio tape, which is nowadays sort of archaic. So I will get that audio for you and possibly we'll be able to listen to that next week. Now, I spoke about my experience with depression and anxiety and depression. And I'd like to just say to you that, you know, if you've never experienced anything of this nature, that's great. I hope you never, ever, ever do. I would never wish it on my worst enemy. No, not even that person. Nope, I wouldn't do it. But the reality is it does happen. There's treatment out there, plenty of options. And what I want to say is that the hardest thing you can do is ask for help. But once you ask for help, it becomes so much easier because it's almost like you're letting out the secret or a lie that you think you're living. But all it is your body saying, "Listen, I need something. I need some help." And we all need help. We all can't survive alone. And this is just another way. If you have a broken leg, can you set your own leg? Can you put it in a cast? Can you write yourself your own prescription for a painkiller for that throbbing leg? We all need assistance. Mental health is just another disease, unfortunately, another disease among the many, many thousands of diseases that are out there that can do us harm. That's all it is, ladies and gentlemen. If you feel that you need help, talk to somebody, sibling, father, brother, clergy, friend, coworker, whatever it takes. That's the first step, and seek some help. Love to hear from you. Always log on to my website, markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com. Love to speak at your school, college, organization, and contact information is on there. Special thanks always to Jason Taubenfeld and Giselle and to Casey. Join in to the program next Thursday from 11 to noon right here on PRN.FM. Gary Null is next. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much to Dr. Jen Hartstein, a New York City psychologist, and a great conduit of some invaluable information. Have a great day, guys.